PGI, please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for the continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, the 7th of May 2015. I'd now like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Professor Jenny Carrier. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's also lucky to be here as it's blowing 130 k's in Wellington and a classic hideous Wellington day, so I hope you're all, most of you are somewhere much better. For me, palliative care is not currently my area of research involvement, but I do just want to say that I did in an earlier part of my career spend 5 years as charge nurse of an oncology ward before actually hospices were established. And through the course of that 5 years, developed inevitably a very strong interest in pain relief, in having informed patients, and the notion of a good death. And in the late 1970s and into the early 1980s, those were, of course, relatively new ways of thinking. And what that's meant for me is that I've retained a very strong support and admiration for the work of hospices. So I'm just working out how to change slides here. So just changing now to slide 3. One of my strongest memories of that time was of tensions between the impetus towards treatment and the desire to improve the quality of life and death. And I remember very strongly as nurses that, you know, while we were obviously very clear about the need for aggressive treatment in some circumstances, it seemed to me that nursing really thrived and came into its own when the time was right to begin actually working in a focused way with a family and with an individual towards securing the best quality of life for that person and the best death possible. Oops, I'm still getting this wrong. So just changing to the next slide. Hospices have, as you all of course know far better than I do, hospices have become the place where those tensions have been addressed and put aside. And the focus is absolutely on helping a person live as well as possible and die as well as possible. And so for that reason, and this is where my involvement and concern does come in, the staffing and the clinical leadership of hospices and of obviously of community-based hospice care is of utmost importance. And as we're becoming more and more aware, the way we integrate with primary care or primary health care is a really significant preoccupation and a very big part of ensuring that patients and their families are actually able to provide seamless service. Just change to slide 5. The health system, as I'm sure I don't need to tell you, is under tremendous pressure at the moment, and all of the indicators would suggest that those pressures will most certainly intensify. Our workforce shortage predictions are quite serious. I understand that there's the prediction of a shortage of 12 palliative care specialists. Nursing is an interesting one in that we are still seeing really good uptake of placements in undergraduate nursing programs. We have the very bizarre situation of not being able to find jobs for our graduates. And we currently have 25% of the nursing workforce internationally qualified. And in fact, I'm chairing a meeting today where one of the things we're talking about is what we should be doing about the immigration in the face of the failure to employ new graduate nurses. The predictions, which have been very well analysed, are that we need to increase New Zealand graduates by 2% a year to sustain the current levels of nursing workforce. But aside from workforce, the pressures on the system coming from increased chronicity, our uncomfortable knowledge that we have quite significant disparities in access and outcomes, and there's a real drive to transform the way we deliver services, to think outside the square, to think about new ways of doing things, to think about using the workforce differently. And that's where I'd like to focus this morning on, particularly on one aspect of using the workforce differently, which is the development of the nurse practitioner role. changing to stage six. I would argue, and many others would too, that there's considerable unutilised potential in nursing, and it's my personal belief that that unused or underutilised potential in nursing could be especially applicable to the needs of patients receiving palliative care, and that applies whether they're in hospices or whether they're at home. And I'm going to argue this morning that nurse practitioners, the role of nurse practitioner, could expand palliative care services in the role of leaders of clinical teams and working, as nurse practitioners are particularly well prepared to do, across hospice and community boundaries, developing expert clinical care to patients. Slide 7. So nurse practitioners obviously are not new, but I'm just going to do a little bit of background for people that perhaps haven't caught up with this movement. The United States has had them for 55 years. In that time, all of the numerous endless research that's been done has produced very strong safety and acceptability data. The important point here is that in the United States, the role of nurse practitioner has title protection, and it is acquired at the end of a clinical master's education. That's the same for Canada, where the history, though, is a shorter one of 8 to 10 years. The title protection and master's also applies to Australia and New Zealand, where we've had nurse practitioners for 13 years. The United Kingdom is the loose unit, or the wild card here. They continue to use the title nurse practitioner indiscriminately. They have some people who are nurse practitioners who are prepared in the way we would consider appropriate. You know, that is the completion of the full clinical master's degree. But they do use the title indiscriminately, and unfortunately they publish data regardless, which is a little bit messy, because you will read papers analysing nurse practitioner efficacy out of the UK and you actually have no way of knowing whether it's a proper nurse practitioner or not. And of course, when we look across all the developing countries, there is the beginning of nurse practitioner establishment. One of the problems I've become interested in lately is that it would be good to have a much more international coherence around the role development. So for slide 8, moving to nurse practitioners in New Zealand, here they're prepared through a 2-year master's degree, following usually at least minimum of 3 to 4 years postgraduate experience. It's often quite a lot more. They're required to determine their scope of nurse practitioner practice against a particular population group. Our first nurse practitioner was authorised in 2001. Right now we have about 140 who are authorised and in a role. But the really interesting point here, and the concerning point, is that there are several hundred nurses, that maybe as many as 12 to 1,500, have actually completed the clinical master's degree but remain uncertain about employment potential because they've not had any encouragement and nobody has actually created a role, even where a clear need or unmet need in a patient or population group exists. Slide 9, we see the nurse practitioner role as the opportunity for nurses to provide the full episode of care. Where appropriate, obviously, be that independently, be it in collaboration with other health professionals, and through doing so that they can improve both access and continuity of care. Moving to slide 10, and we've published a lot about that from New Zealand and Australia, arguing that the nurse practitioner role is a new form of health service. What it does is provide access to diagnosis and treatment, but within a nursing and population approach and retaining the partner's wellness promotion and quality of life focus. So you can see already that it has a very close and comfortable fit with the context of palliative care. Just looking at a little bit of research in slide 11, and this is a very interesting piece of research conducted by Alison Pirrett, who is herself a nurse practitioner who finished her doctorate last year. Now, in her doctoral research, she found no difference in nurse practitioners' diagnostic reasoning abilities compared to those of doctors. The doctors in her sample were final year registrars, and a panel of nurse practitioners and medical specialists reviewed the diagnostic decision making blinded of a group of nurse practitioners and a group of final year registrars. And they found no difference in terms of diagnoses made, problems identified, and action plans proposed from a complex case scenario. Now, in times of global economic restraint, this, I think, this offers us significant potential for alternative models of care. Moving to slide 12. This is a quote that I just love from a physician in 1974, which speaks quite powerfully to me, and I wanted to share it with you. Dr. Bates was writing one of the first textbooks in pathophysiology for nurse practitioner candidates, and she made this statement that by expanding your knowledge and skills into medicine, she's speaking to nurses here, and thereby acquiring some of that control, you can in fact expand into nursing. And she said less medicine when mixed with more nursing is probably better medicine, or to translate, better healthcare. And she finished by saying, by expanding into medicine, you will need more than ever before to increase your consciousness of what nursing is all about. Now, this many 30, 40 years later, that statement has huge resonance to those of us who work in developing the nurse practitioner role. We are very passionate about retaining the connection to and the embeddedness in a philosophical approach to nursing while acquiring some additional skills. Moving to slide 13. Now, that sort of research that I've just talked about, which compares medicine and nursing, is kind of useful if we're talking about safety, because it is what bothers people, but it's also distracting from what's really important. It shouldn't be about comparison. It should be about collaboration and complementarity, and those are the things that that matter much more to all of us. But the nurse practitioner role does have a long history now of demonstrating high levels of consumer satisfaction, comparable safety and efficacy data, but more interestingly, leading new ways of working with people and designing services for those most in need, and for particularly being focused on unmet need. Moving to slide 14. So the Australasian model of nurse practitioner practice is really firmly grounded in nursing, and resistance to medicalisation is very strong. And we've been very compelled, I think, by particularly the work of Christensen, who's always talked about disruptive innovations, and that it's really important to remember that when a health system has become cumbersome and costly and isn't meeting a significant amount of consumer need, we really have to start thinking outside the box. Slide 15. What we've grappled with in New Zealand, I think, in terms of establishing the role, is that employers and funders have had a worldview that's been somewhat at odds to our worldview around the establishment of the role. I think they've constantly seen the role as substitution for medical care, as a cheaper, more dangerous role, as an agenda for nursing promotion. I also think we struggle and have a bit of tension around admitting that we have unmet need in a country with a fully funded healthcare service. You see, in the States, where clearly something like 40, sometimes quoted 50 million people prior to Obamacare have no access to healthcare, it's really easy to develop new ways of doing things and to develop pioneering services such as nurse practitioner services. In this country, we're a little more cagey about actually accepting that there's unmet need. Slide 16. So our main driver for nurse practitioner role development is that we are comfortable that there is a strong and long history of evidence that it is a safe role, and we see it as a potential expansion in service delivery to consumers who might otherwise not get their needs met. But in terms of the kind of thing that gets bandied around about this being about nurse promotion, it does, of course, offer a clinical career pathway for nurses who want to progress in their careers without reducing their close engagement with patients. And there was a time when that potential didn't really exist, and we lost large numbers of nurses into management positions who might actually have chosen to take the nurse practitioner pathway. Slide 17. When we talk about the costs of workforce, this is rather a compelling figure, I find. We did the analysis of the cost of producing a general practitioner versus producing a nurse practitioner. And for the general practitioner, it's over $500,000 a year. That includes undergrad, postgrad, and the PGY years 1, 2, and 3. And for a nurse practitioner, it's $120,000, which is the undergraduate and the postgraduate education. And yet, when we release a general practitioner and a nurse practitioner into practice, their scope of practice, the work they can do, is remarkably similar. In New Zealand, we've had significant challenges, really, developing the role of nurse practitioner. It's been protracted. Remember those significant number of nurses who've done the qualification but actually haven't progressed to become a nurse practitioner. The journey has been fraught with really high levels of ignorance, quite a lot of misinformation, and a number of barriers. Some of them are real, they're legislative barriers, and some of them are simply custom and practice. I was meeting the other day with a nurse practitioner who's actually bought a practice in partnership with a practice nurse in Timaru. She's been there for quite a while now, working brilliantly with a population of about 2,000 patients. And yet she's still having her referral letters into the Timaru Hospital sent back by consultants who say, I don't take referrals from nurse practitioners, even though that is a legitimate and acknowledged part of the nurse practitioner scope. So that's what I mean about custom and practice barriers, but there are real legislative barriers as well that still haven't been sorted. But none of these challenges are insurmountable, and they do show remarkable similarity to exactly what's gone on in other countries. Slide 19. So talking about those legislative barriers, in 2001, we identified 64 pieces of legislation which directly blocked a nurse practitioner's scope of practice, things like signing death certificates, sickness certificates. Now, those are real impediments. And in 2015, a really large number of those barriers remain in place. I don't know the exact number, but it's somewhere around 45, 50 of them. And that's an extraordinary thing, given that there have been many, many projects over the years designed to address the problem and constant attention from nurse lobbyists in trying to get those barriers changed. Slide 21. The Health Practitioner Statutory Reference Bill has been in draft form since 2005, which really is sobering when you think about how desperately we talk about wanting to free up the workforce, free people up to work to the top of their license, develop new ways of working, all the rhetoric, and yet we spend this long putting through a bill that will change some of the things that so desperately need changing. It does, however, look very promising that the Health Practitioner Statutory Reference Bill may go up to become law, maybe not this year, I think now, but next year, we hope. We certainly have our fingers crossed for that. Funding models have been very much sorted, I think, around nurse practitioner practice. And in primary care particularly, nurse practitioners can now enrol patients, claim full capitation, and claim the GMS. And we've had some work done that shows that a nurse practitioner on a salary of $130,000 needs 800 patients in general practice to be financially viable. We also know that a nurse practitioner working across residential care and providing both acute and primary health care has been able to reduce hospital admissions by 28% in 1 year of practice. Now, these are very important pieces of information in terms of supporting us to understand that the role nurse practitioner in whatever context it's placed, has the potential to actually work differently. And by bringing that medical capacity along with a nursing approach to care, and when able to work in a supportive environment with a collaborative team, that in fact we can make some very significant changes to how care is delivered and how people's needs are met. Slide 23. Just bringing you up to speed really with prescribing, because this has also been a long journey. But nurse practitioners now are authorised prescribers rather than what they first became, which was designated prescribers. So this became law in July 2014, and what being an authorised prescriber, previously held by dentists, doctors and midwives, means that the nurse practitioner has open access, limited only by professional judgment, and access to special authority drugs. Importantly, work has now begun on registered nurse prescribing. We have had a small group of registered nurses who are working as clinical nurse specialists in diabetes who've been prescribing under a, you know, a special arrangement. But there's a full application now for registered nurses to be designated prescribers within the scope of primary health care and long-term conditions. And the existing diabetes nurse prescribers will be subsumed into that scope. Now, the Ministry, Health Workforce New Zealand and Nursing Council are working on this application. But I did hear that the New Zealand Medical Association is not comfortable with the notion of registered nurses as designated prescribers and prefers that they will be delegated prescribers. We believe that a careful review of the evidence suggests that delegated prescribing offers no improvement than what we already have from standing orders, and that it is much more dangerous than having registered nurses appropriately prepared to prescribe as designated prescribers, which means that they will have a limited formulary strictly relevant to where they would, to their actual scope of practice. Slide 24. One of the things that happened in passing the Medicines Act, and apparently a bureaucratic oversight, and I try not to be cynical about this, but one part of the regulations wasn't changed, and so it's gone through. Nurse practitioners cannot write standing orders, unlike all other authorised prescribers. And that, of course, is a tremendous drawback as we expand the nurse practitioner workforce. And we've begun the consideration of the process as to how that can be rectified retrospectively. But it just seems sad that we take so long to get the Medicines Act through, and yet it went through without this important part. Slide 25. So moving to the future, there's been a lot of discussion about the nurse practitioner, the process by which we currently train nurse practitioners. Now, currently, almost all of our candidates are working in full-time practice. They do the 8-paper master's degree. The final paper of that is generally, always the final paper, but is always a 1-year prescribing practicum under the supervision of a medical practitioner or a nurse practitioner. And at the end of that 8-paper master's degree and that long period of clinical practice, they apply to the Nursing Council. They comprise a substantial portfolio, which is desk audited, and then they go to the Nursing Council and appear before a panel for an oral viva of 3 to 4 hours in duration. What we find is, and I want to go back now to this group of approximately 1,200 nurses, as I guess said, we don't know that figure exactly, who have a clinical master's degree, who originally intended to become nurse practitioners, but in fact do not put their portfolio up and become authorised because they can't see an employment opportunity. Now, we would like very much, we see that as tremendous wastage of funding, of their energies and efforts, and a loss to the workforce of that potential nurse practitioner. And so Auckland University and Massey University, working in partnership, have designed a final year of the nurse practitioner training program, which will involve a close link to where they're working in clinical practice, two large practicums, one being the clinical practicum, one being the prescribing practicum. And they will be full-time in the program, full-time either in their practice or in the practicum area. And they will have employer support and full Health Workforce New Zealand funding support. And they will be supported to have their portfolio for authorisation completed by the end of that year and a position waiting for them upon authorisation. So this is a tremendous opportunity for different employment areas to embrace a nurse practitioner candidate and put them into either the Auckland or the Massey Masters program. Now, the catch here is that this has gone up for funding to Health Workforce New Zealand. It's received absolute support, but it's going for funding in an incredibly competitive funding bid, and we remain uncertain as to whether it will actually be funded next year. I think it offers a tremendous opportunity for hospice environments to identify nurse practitioner candidates and to see them graduate at the end of the next year as fully fledged nurse practitioners ready to go. And I understand that there is plenty of opportunity to utilise nurse practitioners in that environment. Slide 26. We see over the years that nurses have had quite a fear of the authorisation process. It's very demanding, it's expensive, and there's been a perception of a high failure rate. And it's true that at the very beginning, there was quite a high failure rate, and some of that had to do really with candidates putting themselves forward based perhaps on a belief that because they'd been nursing for a long time, they were ready to go. And of course, that length of time in practice does not replace the knowledge required to be a nurse practitioner, the knowledge that's gained in the master's program. But what we see is that the failure rate has dropped away to almost, it's negligible. And so it's resolving as nurses come to understand the seniority of the role and the need to be absolutely appropriately prepared before going for authorisation. We also are realising that there's a lack of focused mentorship for people, particularly in areas which don't have strong, brave and visionary nurse leadership. And you can see around the country now quite clearly that where that strong nurse leadership exists, the amount of successful nurse practitioner candidates is markedly different from other areas. Recently, some of the more recent changes, and I've moved to slide 27, Nursing Council have made some real efforts to support much more generalist roles for nurse practitioners. So we are encouraging candidates to think about their nurse practitioner role in the area of primary health care, aged care, child health, mental health. But it's important to also note that this does not preclude them also identifying large populations, particularly such as those needing palliative care, as the focus for their nurse practitioner application. And moving to slide 28 and the final slide, I've said all this, didn't realise I'd written it twice. It's absolutely important that nurse practitioner candidates are supported, mentored, encouraged by the not certainty, but the encouragement that a position will be available after they've completed the long journey to authorisation. And so that's my final slide. Well, I think the questions asked have been so useful that they've padded out the things that I perhaps didn't say, and they've enabled me to clarify some of the things I didn't say. So I probably just really want to say to the nurses out there who are considering taking the nurse practitioner journey that I just want to offer you every encouragement, because I think that your services as nurse practitioners in palliative care particularly will make an enormous contribution to a very vital field. Thank you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for your participation. You may all disconnect.